Hello, everybody. You are listening to the Neil Rewind podcast, and my name is Anne van Maurik. Today, we will speak with a part of the team of the research project Bones of Contention about bones and other remains of the war dead in the Vietnam-American War. More specifically, we're going to talk about the political contention about these bones. I'm your host of today, together with my colleague Dat Nguyen, who is also part of the Bones of Contention research group.
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be with you all today. My name is Dat Nguyen, and I'm currently a postdoctoral researcher in the project Bones of Contention here at the NIOD. Anand and I are thrilled to have Dr. Tam Ngo and Dr. Sarah Wagner here with us. Dr. Tam Ngo is the leader of the Bones of Contention project and a senior researcher at the NIOD and the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Religious and Ethnic Diversity in Germany. Dr. Sarah Wagner is professor of anthropology at George Washington University in the United States and a team member of Bones of Contention. So as Anna mentioned, we will be discussing the political contentions surrounding the remains of the war dead of the Vietnam-American War in this episode. Tam, Sarah, and I approach this topic from three different angles of the war, namely North and South Vietnam and the United States.
Tam, about your project, Bones of Contention, let's start with this contention. What's this about?
Thank you, Anne. Throughout my research, I begin to notice that finding and identifying missing war dead is an important task, not only for Vietnam, but technically for any society after warfare. How this task is performed has very strong impact on post-war political reconciliation. So in 2019, I was very lucky to be awarded with a generous and prestigious VD research grant to carry out this project Bone of Contention. The goal of the project is to gain empirical and theoretical knowledge of the process of war dead identification and post-war reconciliation in Vietnam. Well, basically in Vietnam, facing the challenge of finding and identifying millions of missing war dead, Vietnamese families since the 1990s has resorted to what I call spiritual forensics, a variety of spiritual techniques to locate and name the dead. Now, the success of spiritual forensic challenged the Vietnamese government, which is still a communist government adhered to atheism, and also to the Vietnamese state's arbitrary control over whose body can be unearthed and repatriated and whose cannot. So to counter spiritual forensics in 2013, the Vietnamese government began to import top-notch DNA-based forensic technologies, which is also only permitted in the identification of the remains of those who die fighting for, not against, the communist government. Internationally, it is in the search for the remains of the war dead that the US and America has been brought together. It is also in the introduction of DNA forensics that these two former combatant states now sought deeper collaboration and reconciliation.
So just to have a clear overview, you mentioned forensics, and then you have the South Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, and the US. So all these parties are involved, right? Am I missing any parties? Can you elaborate a bit on about this contention between which perspectives? How does this work?
Right. So I use the term bone of contention to describe, on the one hand, literally sorting out the bones, which is part of the whatever left of a person joining war and die for the nations. But at the same time, searching and naming such a person brought to the fore so many form of conflicts, and this the metaphor of bone of contention. Yeah. So the bone of contention in post-war Vietnam has so many dimensions, but let me give you just a few. North-South relation, for instance. The war that we know here in the West as Vietnam War is in fact a civil war between the North and the South, fighting for a form of legitimacy and for a direction they see how the nation should move forward. It is also an international war, which is also very well known here, the involvement of the U.S. Searching and naming the war dead in Vietnam reopened up many of the conflict, the division, the the communication, the dialogues between the state and the people, between military decisions and civil obligations. It also a moment where the question of former fool and how former fools become friends, and of course negotiating that out is a huge question of contention between the U.S. and Vietnam. So yes, North South is one big bond of contention. U.S. Vietnam is another, and last but not least, spiritualities and science, because the technology used to search for the war dead in Vietnam has been competed by different fractions. A part of society believed that the dead can be contacted through spiritual means, and the other part believed that it is all nonsense, pseudoscience, and even straightforward superstitions. And Vietnam is a communist country that has gone through rather significant transformation in the last 20 years, where debate about truth, about the role of science in society, also brought to the fore a lot of conflict. So in searching and naming for the dead, all of these contentious issues are brought into.
And a question for Sarah, how would you describe this contention from the U.S. perspective?
Right, so if you imagine that Tom and I come at this project from these two not opposing sides, in many ways they're informing one another, the Vietnamese government's response to its missing, the numbers of which dwarf that of the American side, and then the Americans in their attempt to recover and to repatriate the remains, the bones of contention from their own troops. So I've spent much time, about a decade, ethnographically and archivally researching the ways in which those bones have been the object of negotiations with the Vietnamese, but also internally in the United States. As you can imagine, the war, the Vietnam War, from the U.S. perspective, has a very fraught history. I mean, it was a contentious war. You had this very strong anti-war protest movement. At the same time, you had a military that, you know, engaged in a war of choice that was protracted, and the costs of which were very human and broadcast daily, you know, on people's television screens. And so it was a war that was full of questions and angers and frustrations and hopes and aspirations. And so those contentions, they bubble up in other ways, but especially around the POW MIA issue. And for the United States, when I say POW, I'm talking about the prisoner of war / missing in action issue. And just as I'm even articulating that, you should hear that the bones of contention in its earliest stage was very much about the contentious claim, you know, are these individuals still alive? If so, why are they not being returned? Where are they? Why isn't the U.S. government doing more to tell the family, inform the families, or to get them back? And then on the other side, the missing in action. If they have, in fact, been killed in action, body not recovered, or their fates have not been resolved, why hasn't the government done more? And of course, the government, the U.S. government, through different iterations of administrations who want to use the contentions for their own political benefits, deflect and put the responsibility at times onto the Vietnamese government. So it's a war that from its inception was fraught with contention, and you can follow that thread in the care for war dead, specifically around this missing in action issue.
Thank you for this, Sarah. And Dot, you are researching the South Vietnamese perspective, right? Can you tell us something about this? What's at stake for the South Vietnamese?
So the other side to this whole the Vietnam-American War is, of course, the perspective of the South Vietnamese. And so at the end of the Vietnam-American War in 1975, the government of the Republic of Vietnam, or known more popularly as South Vietnam, fell. And a lot of the people who was affiliated with the Republic of Vietnam, including military personnel, were effectively marginalized from the post-war nation state. And this includes things like commemorative practices, but also recent adoptions of DNA technology to identify their remains. And so a lot of the contention resolved around the fact that these individuals are, you know, to use the term of another colleague of mine, Alex Tai, stateless in the post-war context. the contention surrounding the memories and the legacy of South Vietnam until this very day inside Vietnam have been very much silenced and muted. So part of the work that I've been looking at is trying to see in which way have sort of people who were affiliated with the South Vietnam government who still remain in Vietnam, how they sort of try to revive these legacies and how can they commemorate and remember them. And of course, in the case of South Vietnam, you cannot talk about South Vietnam without talking about sort of the mass exodus of people, refugees who had to leave Vietnam, South Vietnam at the end of the war. And that created another set of contentions, which is the sort of the history and the memories of exodus and refugee status among South Vietnamese in Europe and also the US more broadly.
If I listen to all of your stories, it seems like there's a lot to do about these bones. As you all described, bones have the capacity to evoke strong emotional reactions. And I can imagine this is different for the Americans than it is for the Vietnamese. And I want to start by the Vietnamese context. Tom, can you explain this in the Vietnamese context?
Now, bones, we all agree that human bones is special objects, is special materials. In the last decades or so, more and more anthropologists come to agree that human remains, bones in particular, possess a form of what they call emotive materialities and affective presence. Because bone have this capacity to evoke emotional reactions, empathies and devotion by their presence as what is left of a person that one lived. So they are human material, they're not just any materials. Bone in Vietnam is particularly special, not only because of this emotive quality that universally belong to humans' material, but bones in Vietnam is special because they are central to the Vietnamese tradition of secondary burials. So let's to give you a very short summary of what a secondary burial tradition is. In Vietnam, death is seen as a process where two times a bury have to be done. The first time happened right after a person deceased. Then the body is buried in the ground. A certain amount of time needed for the body to decay and to return to the soil. But what is left is the bone. And that is when the body is dug up and reburied ritually again. They are cleansed and they are cared for. So once that is done properly, that as a process is seen as being complete, and then life can begin again. Now, what happens when you don't have bone to bury? That puts an enormous stress on society from individual to the state level, and that is what Vietnamese society experienced at last after a century of warfare. In 20th century, Vietnam fought against the French, against the Americans, against each other, and against the Chinese. And only three massive Indochina war cost millions of Vietnamese life. These deaths are seen as bad debt, and that means also potentially millions of angry, restless spirits. How to ease them, how to calm them, how to appease to them. To start with, perhaps, is to place their bones rightly in the soil. And so therefore their spirit perhaps will be appeased. And that is when the problem really begins, that they don't have the bone to bury. So that explains also that massive nationwide movement in beginning of 1990s that Vietnamese society plunged themselves into searching for the remains of the missing and kill in accident.
Thank you. Dust, have you got something to add to this from the South Vietnamese perspective?
Yeah, I can add a little bit about the South Vietnamese perspective. So as sort of Tom mentioned in her response, in Vietnam, the treatment of the dead is a very sort of strong moral issues and moral problems. And so, being able to bury them right, but also to commemorate them properly, are considered to be very important sort of cultural but also moral acts. So in the context of the South Vietnam Dead, there's a lot of issues surrounding, you know, what to do with the dead, particularly those who was fighting for the South Vietnam Army. For this project, with Bones of Contention, I've been doing research in a sort of the former South Vietnam Army cemetery in the south of Vietnam. This space have sort of after the war been sort of prevented, sort of there's limited access to the space. The government, the communist government, basically took it over and turned it into military training grounds and also other purposes. And they prevented easy access to the cemetery up until the mid-2000s when they decided to return the cemetery over to civilian use. And so that's when you started to see more South Vietnamese family coming to the cemetery to pay tribute, to commemorate, and to fix up the space itself. During this time, you see a lot of photos surfaced on social media and on different online platforms of the South Vietnamese community documenting how sort of the graves have been destroyed, the tombstone have been destroyed. And these acts were described as a kind of sort of exemplify a certain cruelty of the communist government towards the losing side. And so that just to show you a little bit about how important it is for, you know, Vietnamese to commemorate the dead properly, even after sort of the war, even after all these political divides should not matter anymore, it still comes up again and again that, you know, how you treat the dead really impact the political conversation and potential for reconciliation. And also, I'm turning this over to Sarah as well. So what does the importance of bones as materiality look like for the U.S.? I know that previously you have also done worked on bone finding mission in Srebrenica. And so from your perspective, what is the importance of bones in the aftermath of war, genocide, and mass conflicts?
Yeah, so I'll start with the U.S. and as a nation state that's used bones in many ways to reorient or to redefine a narrative about this contentious war. So if you think about the United States and its relationship with war dead and bones, from its back to the American Civil War, there's been a sensibility that bones need to return home. So, you know, Northern soldiers' remains had to come back to the North. There was less concern about the South because they lost the war, yeah? But this idea that repatriation was central to an American ethos or set of values around military sacrifice. And that develops. It develops across the 20th century, particularly in the notion that repatriation also then entails not just a return to home, but an individuation, so that names should also be returned to those remains, and those named individuated sets of bones go back to families. Yeah? So that's this ethos. And it's not really until the Vietnam War that the forensic scientific expertise begins to enable that down to the highly fragmented partial bones. Yeah? And there's a fascinating connection, and I can get to it in a moment, between the U.S. military's forensic genetics program that went on to inform the response in Bosnia and Herzegovina, specifically with the Srebrenica missing. But for now, I'll just sort of tease out this line that as the forensic capacity increasingly is more efficacious, more successful in identifying these, you know, bits of bone, that there's there's more of an appetite. There's a demand coming from the families that's being somewhat responded to. But it's also that the Congress is pouring money into a forensic mission that can perhaps, as part of this larger project of sort of scrubbing the history, as the historian Kristen Appy describes, of, you know, sort of reorienting and reconfiguring the Vietnam War's past as maybe not such a stain on our nation's past, but rather there might be something that we can kind of resurrect out of it. Well, forensic science, in its ability to maybe alleviate some of the sting of defeat, we can return these fallen soldiers decades later, and we begin to think about, you know, their sacrifice to the nation. And it joins this larger, you know, panoply of other war dead, right, from potentially more noble causes, such as World War II. Yeah? So at any rate, so there's that side of it where the bones of the fallen are doing work for the state, yes, for the past, but also for the present, right?
For the future.
And exactly. So it's this continuum, right? So they're never static. They're never fixed in the past. They're invited or forced to do, conscripted to do work for the state in the present and the future. And I think there's a little bit of, you know, this connection with Bosnia and Herzegovina. It's a very, very different context, right? DNA as the engine that drove the identification process for the Srebrenica missing, in so many ways that became a tool of truth-telling that could, you know, unearth remains, reassociate highly commingled and partial remains, reassociate and bring them back to the very site where the genocide occurred, so that families could partake in a witness sanctified burial. And that was a way of, you know, evincing, right, attesting to the scale and intensity of the genocide. So they were doing a different form of work, right? They were asserting the scale, the facts of victimhood. And by extension, they're also manifesting, you know, the forms of perpetration, the forms of culpability. Yeah? So so if you think about bones on sort of a national and narratives of national identity, they're extraordinarily sort of fertile ground, or they do this important work. I think we make a mistake when we only operate at the level of the nation, and I think Bones of Contention as a project brings it. It makes sure that we're paying attention to the nation, but it's also because the three of us are ethnographers. We want to spend time with people for whom those bones are more than an object of the nation. They are their loved one. And so thinking about bones as, you know, this tiny bit of my son or my brother or my husband, whoever that relationship, that person is brought back to me, and now I have a chance to care for him. Right? Now I have some answers to where he is, to what happened to his body. I now have the possibility to rebury. I have a chance to create a space of peace and ritual. And that's very much, that's been a common narrative, both with the Srebrenica families with whom I worked, and also with the MIA families, that idea that there's finally a resting place, and that resting place allows a new form of memory making, but also care. Yeah? And that care is no longer in the hands of the state. It's now back with the family, yeah? And the community.
Crucial concepts in your research are necropolitics and necrosociality. Can you explain to us what you mean by them?
Thank you. This concept of necropolitics is now rather well-known in anthropology, in political science, and various fields of study. I won't bother you with the detail who started with it and how it developed. Let me give you a very concrete example of what I mean with necropolitics in Vietnam. I apply the idea that pushed forward by Mbeki and others that the state exercise sovereignty through the right to decide who may live and who must die, to also whose body was the attention of the state and how to manage this body. Concretely, how necropolitics work in Vietnam in the post-war context, in my view, it has to do with the systematic and sometimes also non-systematic, but very much a coherence policy to, first of all, honor the righteous debt, the debt of the hero, the martyr, the who make this ultimate sacrifice, the sacred sacrifice for the nation. So here we are talking about 1.2 million Vietnamese soldiers who die in combat, who die in accidents, and they are honored by the state with this title of martyrs. And it is the state responsibility to give them proper burial, to find their body, and to bring them home to their family. So that is one dimension of necropolitics in Vietnam. The second dimension, very importantly, is to classify the dead to who is hero and who is enemy. And that is the consistent practice of marginalizing the dead of the enemies, namely the South Vietnamese, so who fall out of certain political categories of being good. The third dimension is marginalizing those who fell out of these two categories, either fallen hero or enemy dead. Those who fall in the gray space in between are relegated to the care of the family. So here the state gives back the responsibility to care for this dead by the family. So these are, in my view, three dimensions of necropolitics in Vietnam. Now, what I mean with necro-societies is I borrow this concept from a Korean anthropologist, Chiun Kim. She writes about care for homeless dead in Japan and how that care creates an intense relationship between the living and the dead, how communities are brought together. I see very similar development in Vietnam, in which there is an intense and intimate relationship between the living and the dead. And that relationship, I argue, is produced partly by necropolitics. When the state puts so much emphasis in caring for the dead in the war and post-war context, then Vietnamese population adopt that ethic, but make it to the form of their own use. So they appropriate the dead, they also reclaim the dead, and in that reclaiming, they maintain that relationship that go beyond framework of friendship or local community to the level that all the fallens in Vietnam are seen as guardian spirit. As Vietnamese citizen, you have the duty to take care of them, to respect them and worship them.
Let's stay at the Vietnamese context for a bit, and after that, I want to really hear your story about this, Sarah. Dot, can you tell us how you use these two concepts of necropolitics and necrosociality?
So as Tom already sort of alluded in her response, in the case of South Vietnam, the sort of necropolitics played out in the sense of, you know, the war dead of South Vietnam, particularly the military dead of South Vietnam, was deemed as the enemy dead, right? And so they were not receiving the same kind of recognitions and commemoration that the revolutionary dead in Vietnam would have been receiving. And even the cemetery space that I talked about briefly earlier, that was also how it was neglected and how it was given to disrepair. That's a manifestation of how necropolitics operate on the ground. In terms of necrosociality, I mean, you can see that very clearly sort of in the kind of ritual work that a lot of families are starting to do to commemorate the dead again at that particular cemetery space, once they have access to the space again. So when I was doing my research, I was following a group led by a former South Vietnamese combatant, and this group, you know, composed of him, other veterans, family members, but also young people from South Vietnam as well, who, you know, we go to this space on a weekly basis in order to sort of do some upkeeping work at the cemetery. So clean the graves and the area around it, chop down some overgrown weeds and things like that, but also performing ritual activities to sort of basically bring the dead back into a certain kind of social rhythm and ritual rhythm. And that's to me is an exemplification of necrosociality, where the bond between the dead and the living is so strong in the context of Vietnam that it, you know, creates a certain kind of moral demands on people. And so even after all this time where people cannot access this cemetery space, they still return to it, and they still sort of try their best to maintain a certain kind of upkeeping, a certain kind of dignity to the space. And, you know, from my perspective, what they're doing is also, you know, it's a kind of demand for social recognition, a kind of social justice in the aftermath of the war.
So as Tom mentioned, necropolitics as a conceptual frame has been very important to social scientific analyses of forensics used as a kind of tool in investigating human rights abuses, in responding to missing persons. And for me, it sort of boils down to, among other things, it boils down to the question of which missing count. And so if you juxtapose the Vietnamese and the US side in the last 50 years, I mean, The U.S. had 2,600 missing, or 2,500 missing in action, killed in action, body not recovered. Those two categories get conjoined. And I mentioned this in the very beginning, this dwarfs the number for the Vietnamese, which 300,000 are missing. Yeah. And so necropolitics, among other things, shines a spotlight on which dead count, what resources are marshaled to not just locate, repatriate, and identify, but also to use them to tell the larger story of the war. If I were to say, you know, I haven't used necrosociality as much in my own work. Instead, there are moments where I've turned to another scholar, and that's Isaías Rojas Pérez, who writes about necro-governmentality. So we're all pulling off of this necro-politics conceptual frame. And
do you have an example of this governmentality?
Over the last 35 years, the U.S. has developed this robust forensic scientific infrastructure for accounting for missing war dead. And for many, many years, this process was driven by the POW-MIA advocates, right? These are surviving family members who pushed for accountability, pushed for answers, pushed for remains. So I mentioned earlier that the U.S. Congress at a certain point, particularly as forensic genetics becomes this increasingly powerful tool, has expectations, right? It's pouring in a lot of money. We're talking about maybe $150 million per year dedicated to this process. Yeah? And the problem is that with all that money, they have expectations. The expectations are, and this began around 2010, that by 2015, the laboratory, you know, this facility should be achieving 200 identifications per year. Now, with the bones of contention from Southeast Asia, there simply aren't that many bones coming in the door, let alone, you know, cases that have been sitting on the shelves, so on and so forth, right? So they don't have the numbers there. And there's also, because of the memory work that the remains of the Vietnam War have been doing, there are all these new factions, right? These new advocacy organizations on the part of Korean veterans, right? The Korean War unknowns, the unreturned, the unidentified, and World War II. Well, lo and behold, there's somewhat low-hanging fruit with thousands of individual sets of remains that have been buried as unknowns for World War II and the Korean War in national cemeteries around the world. But specifically right where that lab is located, the forensic scientific lab is located, on the island of Oahu, so in Hawaii. So they start a program of disinterring the remains of unknowns where they have, say, a strong suspicion because of archival research that it might be one of, say, 10 or 15. In fact, this program of disinterment and identification has yielded lots of results. Yeah? So the attention begins to shift. And you have to understand, in this necro-governmentality shifting of resources and attention and narratives, that the families of Southeast Asia who feel like we brought all of this into existence thanks to our advocacy, thanks to our protests and our demands, this infrastructure even exists. Now you're shifting attention. So remember the question that I was asking in the necropolitical question, well, which missing or which war dead count? Here we see this governmentality, you know, is you know, forced by Congress, who wants an accountability for, you know, the forensic work, and they want the output, right? They want to be able to say, we're bringing these home. And I'm an American, I can say, Americans, we like our PR, right? And the Pentagon knows its PR. We like our story of the fallen returned home. And yeah. So it may make the national news, but more often than not, this is about local newspapers and local television stations covering, you know, the moment those remains hit the tarmac on the local or, you know, the nearby airport and then are driven to, and this, I chronicle this in my own book, that this is, it's a homecoming that people can sort of rally around. And yes, it's about the family, but then it also is very much about the community. So it's, you can see the fruits of the necro-governmentality in these stories of a nation that brings its fallen home, yeah, and is exceptional in the way it does so, and its dogged pursuit of that aim.
So our Bones of Contention team organized this international conference from June 8th to 9th, called Actions for the Missing: Scientific and Vernacular Forms of War Dead Accounting. And at the conference, we and colleagues from different universities and research institutes discussed comparatively how people deal with remains of the war dead in other social and historical contexts. And one question that I've been wanting to ask, and maybe Tom and Sarah can shed some lights on this, how do the cases of the war dead from the Vietnam-American War help us understand these other contexts, including, for example, the current Russia-Ukraine war? And what are certain insights that you have found translatable?
Well, I think at the conference, we share a common view that what shocks us all is the image that we recently see. We are still seeing it in our media today of what's happening in the war between Russia and Ukraine, the image that brought so close to home, this human body being destroyed by war. And then what shocks us even more is image of a soldier body from Russia being left behind, being kept in kind of very terrible conditions, but they are abandoned. So that raised the question that has been raised in so many other contexts, necropolitics, or how this body tells us the intention to exercise sovereignty in Russia through the manipulation of this body, first send them to war and then abandon them to that extent. And the question raised is what they are going to do in the aftermath of war. Will they continue this, what we are seeing today in Vietnam, in the US, in everywhere else? Or if they don't follow that path of searching and finding and naming their own soldier, then what does it say about them? Do we are we seeing here a new form of necropolitics?
Those of us who are watching from the outside in and, you know, are seeing these images, alongside that, we're seeing different responses to different bodies, right? Yeah. So there are civilians, there are members of the military, there are infrastructures that are being sort of created or levied. So there are international investigations that are beginning to take place, as I understand, from the ICC. There's the Ukrainian, their own state prosecutors. So there are going to be, as there are in many other contexts, I'm thinking here of what I saw emerge in Bosnia and Herzegovina, that there is, you know, one tract is the medical legal response that is often used to produce evidence about war crimes. And then there's this other side, and they're entwined. The other side is the humanitarian response of trying to provide family members with answers, with, you know, knowledge about what happened to their loved one, and most importantly, the return of remains. Yeah? And so I think, you know, often that first tract tends to, you know, push. It tends to be, I don't know, maybe in the driver's seat, you know, in establishing crimes, right? Because we're talking about states and states at war. But the scenes from the Ukraine are absolutely tragic because it's also where the state cannot enter in, right? When they don't have the resources or they don't even have the access to spaces where remains are, you know, they're left to families or even strangers to care for. So all of that is what's unfolding now. And so often we want our ready fix. And maybe there's a little bit of, with this international regime of forensic science sort of swooping in and doing this work of accounting and social repair, the expectation that these sites, these spaces, these bodies, that they can be fixed. They can be, you know, there can come something out of this that repairs, that stitches together. And I think it is so premature. I mean, among other things, we need to send to the families of the missing civilians, the missing combatants, and imagine what are their needs, right? Before we start telling tales about, you know, the importance of states and their needs in solving the conundrum of war debt.
Tom, Sarah, and Dot, thank you so much for being here and to illuminate us on your fantastic project, Bones of Contention. I think the end date is in 2025, am I right?
Yes, the end of 2024.
And I'm really looking forward to hear about it more. So, yeah, I will keep me updated. Thank you so much.
We will. Thank you, Anne, for this wonderful conversation.